Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at centofinefoods.com, King Arthur Flour at kingarthurflour.com, and Cola Vita at colavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Folks, welcome. Food Talk here with Mike Colomeco, Heritage Radio Network. What's today's date? It's April, the 3rd of April, and it feels like the 3rd of April. It feels like spring. First day in a long time that actually feels like the icy grip of winter has lost its touch. It must have hit 65, almost 70 today. Ran across the Williamsburg Bridge in a t-shirt and shorts, and it was hot then. Just felt great, great, great to be in New York. So maybe we'll have winter finally in our rearview mirror. That's the hope around here. Anyway, we've got a great show coming up today. Had a great meal. I wanted to mention this. I had a great meal last week. I think I mentioned I was going to go. The chef, Keith McNally, is executive chef, is corporate executive chef. So a guy named Shane McBride. He's a great guy. I knew Shane back when he was at L'Espinasse, way back when L'Espinasse was one of those 4-star restaurants in the St. Regis Hotel with a great dining room. He was with Christian Delouvrier. And speaking of Christian, I was Christian's sous chef at the Maurice for 2.5 years back in the 80s. So he was one of my mentors. And Christian is, he says he's 70. I think he's a little older, but whatever. Who cares? He ain't young. And he's in the kitchen all the time. He's at a restaurant on the Upper East, kind of Upper East Side, 53rd, 54th, and 2nd Avenue called Le Mangeoir. I think it's French for the manger. Don't ask me why, but it's not his restaurant. He didn't choose the name. But he's been in the kitchen for a while. So anyway, Shane and I went up, and I took my son. Shane had his girl with him, and we just had an amazing meal. Old school, classical French. So, so good. What did we drink? It was a bio wine. It was a bio organic. Was it Loire Valley? I should remember what I drank. Did I take a picture of it? I don't know. But I know this. We started out with one thing, and then we had two bottles of that. And as usual, when we got to the end of the meal and got the bill, the alcohol portion of the bill was substantially bigger than the food portion of the bill, which happens to me more often than not. I'm like, how did we spend XYZ on what we ate? And then I thought, well, really? Think about what you drank, you know. And then, of course, there's always that bottle at the end when you're almost done eating, and it's like, let's do another bottle. You know, what are we going to do? Wine by the glass? No, let's bring on another bottle. Yeah, yeah. So, at say, 65 per bottle minimum, times that, times three, and that, yeah, there you go. That, welcome to my world in the restaurant business. At least I didn't start with a Negroni or two like I usually do. Yeah, no, we started with champagne. And it got even funnier because we got done eating and Christian came down to sit with us. He's such a gracious, gracious guy. It was about 10:30. The kitchen must have slowed down. We'd been there since 7:30. So that's the kind of night it was. And Shane had brought with him a bottle of champagne for all of us to drink at the end of the meal. And I don't remember the vintage. I should, but I was at that point not paying much attention. But it was Dom Perignon, so it wasn't bad. Little DP at the end of the meal for just for good measure, to toast everybody. Anyway, I want to introduce my first guest today. We've got two guests on the show. We're going to talk about wine, and I want to apologize on air for Joey Campanile, who has a show on this very network that devotes itself to wine every week. I've known Joey since he opened Del Anima, and I met him on the street because I used to live about a block south of Del Anima on Abington Square for a long time, and Del Anima was a huge hit. Since then, they've gone on and opened up Artusi and the one off the Bowery, and they're the kid's on fire. When I met him, he looked like he was about 18, which meant he was probably 23, 24. He's really into wine. He's one of those bright young wine guys. And anyway, he has a show on this network. So my excuse is this: I have been drinking wine longer than he's been alive, so I am allowed, based on that, to talk about wine on my show whenever I feel like it. So there we go. So anyway, my guest today, two guests. First guest is a great sommelier. I'm not going to call her a rock star or a star. No, 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 because I've done that before and she's objected. So I'm just going to say she's one of the most highly regarded sommeliers working on the floor today at a restaurant called Rouge Tomate, Upper East Side, 60th off of Fifth Avenue. It's a great restaurant. It's an amazing restaurant. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then Sam Hazen, who is a veteran New York chef who's probably been here as long as I have, if not even a little longer. I've known Sam for a long time. Years back, I did a tribute show to Chef Jean-Jacques Rachou, who was really one of the most important French chefs of the last generation in New York, because he was the first French chef that allowed American cooks to work full-time in his kitchens. Which is a hard thing to imagine, but up through the 1970s, you could not work as an American in any of the French kitchens. Caravelle, Lutèce, La Côte Basque, Le Périgueux, you had to be French. It was a little mafia. That's a fact. And the first guy to ever hire Americans full-time was J.J. Rachou. Got thrown out of the Vitel Club for it. Caused a big uproar, but we can thank Jack for that. And anyway, so Sam goes back to that kitchen in those days. He was at Dow when they opened that, Rue 57, Veritas for a very good 3-star review, and now he's going to be in the hotel executive chef business. But we'll save that for the halfway point of the hour. Pascaline Lapeltier, welcome to Food Talk.
Hi.
So, you and I were just on TV. Well, we filmed. We weren't on TV. We'll be on TV. We filmed a while back. So some of this is going to sound familiar, but I want to reintroduce you to an audience that may not know you. Talk a bit about background, because you didn't. It's not like you were into wine at 13 or 14, and you studied. You went to Bordeaux to the wine school down there. No, no, you kind of can't. Well, you tell the story where you're from in France, which is important because we're going to go to that region and talk wine. Yeah. How you got into wine and when it was and why.
So you want on my life?
Well, kind of. And we're talking about surfing at the end. We're going to wait till the end.
Yeah, please, let's talk about surfing. I'm French. I'm sure you're going to notice that right away. I'm not trying to hide my accent. Probably it's going to help. It helps me to sell a lot of bottles of wine on the floor. But it's not very simple. You know, French girl. I grew up in a Loire Valley, surrounded by vineyards, but not at all into wine, as you said. 13, I was probably drinking beer already, and like 18, I was probably drinking kind of very bad flavored booze. Difficult 18. And I was studying to get into humanities and philosophy, and things happened that I decided I was not ready to become a philosophy teacher, kind of too young and not seasoned enough. And I was just extremely lucky to have one of my philosophy teachers into wine. So he opened me a couple of bottles. I was like, wow, this is pretty nice, pretty good. Started to make money working in restaurants. Wine crossed my path again. And was like, wow, I really like wine. And I have to say, like, being in Angers, like where I grew up, so in the middle of the Loire, I realized that I was starting to spend my weekends hanging out in vineyards. So everything happened at one point where I just took a sip of a very famous French wine. It was Zicken 37. I was finishing an internship to have an MBA in hospitality management. And that day I was like, wow, I'm done. I'm going to dedicate my life to wine.
Chateau Zicken 47.
37.
Yeah. Incredible.
So that's it. And an intellectual orgasm that day. And boom, got into wine. So...
educated yourself by drinking, tasting, doing what normal people do. Keep a notebook or whatever, because back then we weren't taking pictures on our iPhones.
I know I was not taking pictures. And you know I was studying philosophy, so I probably have like 1,000 notebook of tasting notes with like physics, metaphysics, and all that kind of...
You're way better off at wine than philosophy. Philosophy is considered the contact sport of academics. It's a bunch of guys in America. It's a really boring place to be.
Oh, yeah?
Not good. Bunch of guys like to bruise each other's egos. So there was a competition, and I don't want to keep raising, you know, the pom-poms, but there was a competition that takes place annually in France for Sommelier of the Year.
It's every 2 years.
Every 2 years.
Yeah, it's like, it's very strange when you move from a very big university background and you want to go to very practical stuff in France. It's very, very difficult. Nobody really believes in you. Like, you can't really easily switch path. So one of my only way to kind of reassure myself I could do this job was to go into competition, which means a lot of theory to know, and I was pretty good at theory. So, yeah.
Oh, that's right. See, you're smart. So you can read stuff and remember it.
I wouldn't say smart. I have a good memory.
Yeah, that's good. No, that's good, because I don't. So that's, I mean, I know that one of the, on the technical side, like friends of mine that study for the Master Psalm, it's just like, oh my God, if it was only about tasting wine, why we enjoy it, identifying variety, if it was just about that, it would be one thing, but it isn't. There's that whole dark side of roots and history and viruses and obscure stuff that we don't really need to know about necessarily that affect our enjoyment of wine, but that's a big part of the test and the competitions.
Yeah, MS and all that stuff is a big part, but I think you have a very good point. Like, the number of people that come to me and say, you know, I don't get wine, I don't taste well, I don't know anything, and blah, 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 and I think people are kind of still scared about it because they just believe you need to be a really huge, big, smart person to be good into wine, and it's not true at all. I think the only thing you need to have is it's a decent memory, and everybody has a decent memory.
And a decent taste memory.
Yeah.
Decent palate, decent nose, decent taste memory.
You can practice that. You don't need to be a super taster. Right. There is no such thing about super tasting. Just care and memory.
So to I'll answer my own question. So you just, and which is, and you're so smart. You know, it's funny because France, there's a real conundrum, right? So in France, if you were on an academic trajectory into your 20s and then you want to step off of that, it's really hard to do because everyone else was doing whatever you, let's say you wanted to become a chef, they've been doing that since they were 13, and you're like, what are you, you're an interloper. It's really hard because they peg, it's, and that's not just true in France, but I know it's true that you're kind of pegged early as to a path. And deviating from that path isn't easy.
Yeah, and in France, it's very like difficult with the laws. You know, the work laws are way more difficult than in the US. So you can just shut up and say, hey, I want to work for free for you. They're like, you can't. So you're right. Like, okay, what do I do now? I can't work for free. I can't be hired anywhere. So
what am I supposed to do? That's right. Yeah. So you came in second, which is huge. Second place in this national competition in, you know, a country that prides itself in being maybe one of the, well, certainly one of the world capitals of viticulture. I mean, Bordeaux and Burgundy kind of have been doing this for a long time at the highest levels.
And Loire.
We're going to get to Loire. All right. So you come to the States. When did you come to the States? When you actually heard about the job at Rouge Tomat?
Yeah, no.
Well, talk about how you got hired, because this was funny. This is a funny story. And I heard this. Did you tell me the story? Or did the owner of, off camera, the owner of Rouge Tomat, who's a Belgian guy, told me this story about how you were hired a year before the restaurant opened.
Yeah.
And they thought, oh, this is ridiculous. We don't need this kid on the payroll. So he went to Paris with the intention of what?
Of firing me.
This is a true story, and I didn't hear it from you, so you tell this story. So you're offered a job, and you kind of accept the job, and you're working for them, and then the guy comes.
Yeah, I was hired by the development team in Paris at the time to open Rouge, so the whole idea was because I had a university background, and I was at that time out of, I just spent a year and a half in a two-star Michelin in France as a sommelier. I had a double kind of profile, and we're looking for someone like that, being able to write process and to think practical, and somebody also a bit into organic wine. So I was hired by the team in Paris to develop the program for Rouge Tomat New York, but the owner didn't know about it. And and he discovered about me, and he went in fact to Paris to say, you know, guys, I think it's just too early to have so many people preparing the opening. Let's wait and see how it goes. And I had no clue. I was just supposed to meet with the owner, and we met and we chat for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and he left, and we had a fantastic conversation. Nothing happened, and 6 months after that, I said, hey, you know, by the way, that day I came just to fire you, and you started to speak about wine, so I decided to keep you with us.
So on that note, because that's a classic. I mean, the guy really, he told me this. This is not public information. He was not on camera, and he said, oh yeah, Pascaline's great. We hired her, and then I thought, this is too soon. I went to Paris to fire her. I get off the train. I meet this girl. She's so smart. She's so good at what she does. She's so passionate. I just thought to myself, fuck this. I can't. I got to keep her. Forget about it. I'm tail between his legs. He goes home. That's it.
Oh yeah. It's,
so let's talk about wine. So enough. All right. You've put together a list at Rouge that has really been recognized. Two reasons. One is it's very heavy on bio and organic, which is something I want to talk to you about. And because it's there is a lot of representation of your home Loire Valley, of that region. Now, there's been a lot of great wine coming out of the Loire, and I think part of it may be a little while back, if you were a vigneron in France, where you cannot afford Burgundy, you cannot afford Bordeaux, you might have ended up in Sud de France, Languedoc-Roussillon. That was a possibility, yeah, which became a big bio and organic place. You're certainly, I mean, the Rhone's going to be tough, but the Loire, it was a little bit cheaper. So you had a lot of young, stoked, yes, experimental winemakers saying, this is, I love the soil, I love the varietals. Talk a bit about the list that you put together and why you think bio and organic, because, and we're in agreement on this, I mean, I do too, is a really, maybe the most interesting space in winemaking today.
Yeah, so Loire, it's I'm a buyer, I'm biased because I am from the Loire, but the more I know about wine, the more I go back to this region. First, historically, there is wine in the Loire since thousands of years now. So there is a whole social aspect of the wine that I think is extremely important when we are sharing a glass of something. There is history behind. And then the Loire, you can find absolutely everything you want in the Loire, every style of wine you like. And as you said, for a very great price, with a very high quality, with a lot of different personalities, with a bunch of different grape varieties. And so if you're a bit curious, it's just heaven. You know, it's really heaven. Heaven when you drink them and heaven when you go and visit these guys. Because you are not going to be welcomed by an export director when you're going to go and ring at the door and say, hey, can I come and have a tasting? No, you are going to really meet the maker. You are going to meet the winemaker. And so that just for me represents what this wine is all about. How you share a place, or you share an history, or you share a landscape, or you share something that is at the end, something you want to drink and not something you want to speculate on and sell in Hong Kong for 10 times the price you bought it. And that's just make me love the Loire. You can keep the wine, age the wine, just pop up a cork today and just enjoy a bottle that is from 2013. So it's a fantastic area to learn, to drink and to enjoy. So it's why I like this region more and more and more. It's every time I go back to my region, and I travel quite a bit now all over the world to see vineyards. Every time I come back, and I was like, wow, this is really a fantastic place to be and to make wine.
So the Loire sits to the west of Paris, has a little, well, not exactly coastal, but sort of, I'm thinking of the coastal. On its furthest west, you'd have vineyards producing Muscadet.
Yeah.
As you begin to come inland, and then there's sort of the high Loire and the lower Loire, you begin to see Sauvignon Blanc, Chenin Blanc, Cab Franc on the red side, Merlot on the red side, some other varietals that I'm if you get into Touraine, you know, even stranger stuff. But you're right. I mean, the wines can be everything from a nice light Muscadet, which is just like this perfect summer quaffing seafood, oysters, whitefish wine, to these Chenin Bourgogne that are just these winter stew, you know, kind of stuff I go to for that kind of food. You talk about the varietals and kind of the personalities of them. Because you're right, you could get everything from light, middle to heavy.
Yeah, it's also pretty easy to understand. You know, it's not like billions of things to know. You can really grasp the idea of that stuff. So as you said, the Loire is a river. The river is flowing from central France to the Atlantic. And it's pretty easy to get when you just follow the river. So if we start from the Atlantic and we go upstream, you start, with the Muscadet, the Fief Vendéen, so it's a coastal region. For the Fief, you don't see them very, very often here, so I'm not going to speak about that. But Muscadet, fantastic wine made with Melon. Melon is coming from Burgundy. So you can find everything from light, crisp, refreshing white to much more serious Muscadet now that are a bargain if you like Chablis. The cru du Muscadet now are like, for the price, are the equivalent of pretty decent white Burgundy from the north.
And they age really well, too, which is a wine you don't think of. Yeah, so the guys at Maison Premier in Brooklyn here have a wonderful, deep Muscadet list.
I know, yes, it's fantastic. Like, you can, like, right now I'm pouring some 1989, you know, and it's like, it's really incredible, 89, like 20, 30 years old, no problem for Muscadet.
Wow.
So it's money for your bank, like you pay that $15 or $20 today and you can keep them 10 years. So this is a Muscadet. Then you go and you move toward the central the Loire, like where you get Angers and Tours. We call that Anjou Saumur. and Touraine, where you have mostly two grapes, I would say, if you want to simplify, Chenin for the white and Cabernet Franc for the red. Chenin, for me, is the greatest grape in the world. From Chenin, you can do everything.
You do love it.
No, I mean it.
It's wonderful.
But you know why? Because you have very, very few grapes in the world, first, that can really express soil variation. Wherever you put them, there will be a variation on that. Then few grapes where you can do from bone dry to extremely sweet to bubbles.
Mm.
When you think about it, how many grapes can do that?
Basically none. I mean, Chardonnay doesn't go to the sweet side.
No.
It's the only two. It's two of your three, but not three of the three.
You get
Chenin Blanc's been pretty amazing.
And you age them
extraordinarily
well. So you get the Chenin. Chenin on limestone, Chenin on slate, an extraordinary thing to discover and to taste. And as you said, Cabernet Franc, wonderfully age-worthy, Chinon, Bourgogne among them. And then you move towards the central... more a little bit of central eastern side of the Loire, and here you arrive in a world more of the Sauvignon Blanc and the Pinot Noir, with, as you said, a couple of indigenous grapes all around, like Pinot de Nice, which is a big one for me, the grapes
that
I really, really like.
And
you
and where go. Where am I going to find Pinot de Nice? Where's it? I'm not going to see it on the label, so where am I going to?
You find it on the east side of the Touraine. Coteau du Vendômois is making Coteau du Loire, so it's more a little bit on the northeast side.
Mm.
And Pinot de Nice has nothing to do with Pinot Noir.
Right.
It's not the same family, not exactly the same family. Super spicy, like earthy, beautiful structure and texture, and especially right now for summertime, if you like, just look for some Pinot de Nice Touraine and this part. And then, we flow towards the Loire and we arrive in Sancerre. And Sancerre, beautiful Sauvignon Blanc, and people tend to ignore that, but fantastic red and rosé from Pinot Noir based. So three main regions, the Muscadet with the Melon, the central part, Chenin Cab, and then the east. And in every of these old sub-regions, you get a bunch of indigenous grapes that we have to explore. Gros-Lot, Romorantin, Courchevernie, which is superb, Menu Pinot, and so on and so on and so on. And pricing still are ridiculous.
In New York, one of my go-to stores, if you're listening to this broadcast and wanted to know where to find a great selection of Loire, is Chambers Street. It's always sort of specialized.
Yeah, David has made so much for the Loire in this country.
Yeah, I give him props.
Extraordinary.
I mean, when I was living in the West Village, it was a couple of subway stops down, but the Chambers Street in Tribeca is really deep, and everyone on the floor there knows the bottles and the varietals. It's a great place to go. Of course, now we have good wine stores all over the city. I had Roger Daghorn here, and I think you know who Roger is. I had Roger here a while back. It was like having Yoda in the house. He's the best. And I asked him the question I'm going to ask you, and I really loved his answer. Talk about, we're seeing in the last 10 years a kind of an explosion of bio and organic wines in the marketplace, to the point where wine stores now will probably have their own section separate from the rest of the wines.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking for that, you don't have to spin around a million bottles. You can say, where's your bio? What do you think it makes a difference? How and why?
Oh, it's a huge subject, but...
I'll ask you for your soundbite answer.
Sometimes it's very tricky for people to understand when they don't visit the place. You know, it's so obvious when you go and walk the vineyard and you see an organically or biodynamically farmed vineyard next door to a very hardcore conventional, which is like looks more like an highway during August and absolutely out of life. So the whole thing is very few people are aware of what you can put into a bottle of wine today, which
in terms of ingredients,
in
because
terms of additives,
there is hundreds.
So wine is not only made with fermented grape juice today, or not all the time, and this is the issue. And the whole idea with biodynamic and organic and the explosion today is people start to really understand that the only way probably to first preserve their vineyard, preserve the plant, keep the plant alive, because with a lot of treatment today, the plants and the vine tends to die way earlier than they used to. Plants can live 100 years, no problem. Now they live, 25, 30 years? They are very weak. Why? It became a monoculture. It became a monoculture with some clones and a certain type of treatment that the plant doesn't grow the right way. Thus, how do you want the grapes to be grown the right way, and what you want the grapes to provide what is need to be provided to make a wine? So what do? You compensate in a winery, and we moved from a farming side of the winemaking 60 years ago to something way more winemaking side with a lot of oenologists and all the schools and all that stuff. So you can almost correct everything in a winery. So what's the point of having off your grape? Because you can do whatever you want in winery. It's easier and less expensive and so on and so on and so on. So today people are reacting to that. They're like, the wine we are drinking, they don't express anything really. We can't recognize them. Our plants are dying. So it's the reason why we need to go back to something which is observation of plants, biodiversity, treatments with probably something more careful way. And then in a winemaking techniques is like going back to something super simple, because wine for years have been pretty simple. And it's like you crush, you wait, there is
you
some
grow,
yeast.
You crush, there's fermentation happens with natural yeast.
It's nothing new, you know, Egyptians were doing the stuff like before us. Of course, always like the sulfur was used way before people think about, but as a preservative.
Right.
And so that's it. And when at the end, what you have in your bottle is something that you want to drink, and that has a taste that is way more expressive than industrial ready-to-drink beverage.
And that's so, I mean, it's so obvious in as a wine drinker and as a consumer. By no means am I an expert, just an enthusiastic enjoyer. There initially I would notice as soon as the wine was poured, if it was a blind tasting or if I was at a restaurant and someone else ordered, the nose was completely different, completely alive, completely different. Yeah. Not just barnyard and funk, but a kind of
diversity,
something else. And those wines would change so much from glass to glass throughout the bottle, which you don't see with a lot of other wines, where the first glass is very much like the second or third glass and kind of like the last glass. I mean, I've had bio wines where they just keep surprising me. You know, 20 minutes in, 40 minutes in, an hour in, how much it changes. And Roger said the same thing. And to your point, and to people listening, if you having walked through organic and bio vineyards, the ground's full of stuff that's growing. It's got snails, it's got bugs, it's got weeds and roots and herbs growing all around it. It looks almost overrun. It looks unkempt by traditional standards. And the traditional vineyards, as you, to your point, look like a highway. There's rows and rows of grapes and then plowed, dug-up ground with just dirt and clay staring up at you and nothing else growing. Barren. Just the vineyard. Just the vines.
Yeah, like, and it's getting even worse because, like, it's what you can see, but people don't realize that what is the most important is a root system that you can't see. And nobody is, like, giving money to study that part and how the grape is able to extract minerals from the soil. So it's even worse when you dig into a little bit. And so it's a statement, you know. We have the list at Rouge-Tomate like that. I work since 7 years with this company. Since the beginning, it has been like that. We think it's better. If we think it's tastier, and we think it's important for us to be a spokesperson.
And to your point, those of you that know, great. Those of you that didn't, to be biodynamic, you're working the fields with horses or mules. You know, a lot of them.
Yeah, there is a lot of different ways of doing it.
Rather than
it.
Heavy machinery for a root, for the health of the root.
Yeah, there is a whole idea of compacting the soil. So how do you have a soil which is alive? You have also the idea of carbon footprint, so you can be organic. But if you go in your tractor and you are going 20 or 30 times a year, you know, maybe you are going to also, the pollution is going to be very high. So it's a case-by-case thing, but at the end, all these guys want to observe, they want to preserve their plants, they want to recreate biodiversity, and they don't want to use any product that can damage the future of the vineyard, including also copper, which is a problem right now. Like a lot of organic and bio guys are using copper, which may not be the ultimate solution because it's a heavy metal, but they are thinking how can they decrease that. So there is just coming back to observe and to respect what you are working with, instead of saying, hey, I'm God and I'm just going to make you do what I want you to do to the plant. You know?
And so much of these wines are made, I mean, again, one of the great comments is that the wines are made on the vine, not post-fresh. The taste of the wine is completely determined by how it grew, how it handled, how the season was, when they decided to pick and ferment. And post that, it's, you know, no one's stepping in and adding stuff.
Yeah, and they can add a little bit of something, but nothing compared to that. Yeah. And I think you and I, you want to do something. There is a vintage on the label. There is a reason why. There is a region of origin for. There is a reason why. When I open a bottle and there is a vintage and a region, I want to taste the vintage and the region. I don't want to taste something that has absolutely nothing to say. So I would say people can be a bit scared about all that stuff. You just try, you know. It doesn't cost you a lot. There is, as you said, a bunch of extraordinary wine shop in New York. If you don't know where to start, you just go to your wine shop and you say, I would like to spend $10 on a good bottle of organic wine. What can you recommend? And see if the guy is giving you something you like and start to have this dialogue. When you go to a restaurant, ask to taste the wine, you know. You want to taste the by the glass? I have a bunch of by the glass. It doesn't cost me a lot to give you a nice taste. And don't be shy. You're going to create your own palate, and your palate is going to feel it the way that when you have, you know, a freshly squeezed orange juice versus something in a can that you buy at the airport, I can tell you, you taste the difference pretty even.
That's a great point. With a minute or so left, tell me about a wine, because you're tasting all the day. One of the great things of your job is you've got wine importers coming to you, sales people coming to you, men and women. You're tasting constantly, pulling corks. What have you tasted lately that has you stoked, that's kind of interesting? I know there must be a million, but was there one or two that jumped out?
No, there is a huge million. When you came, at the restaurant, we tasted some Hungarian, and the other day, I have the winemaker of a new winemaker coming from Hungary, and I did a pretty fantastic tasting of a dry foaming from Hungary that you don't see a lot around, and you are like, well, there is so many wine from wine regions that are not really considered right now that I need to keep on exploring. I just can't say I know things because when I have this type of thing happening. So it was a dry Zamaroni from Tokaj, from Tinon. That was pretty, pretty stunning.
You have it on the list?
Yeah.
You're going to buy it?
It's already on the list.
I'm coming in for a glass soon. Thanks so much. You know, I got to get you back because I'd love to talk to you about...
We need to talk about surfing.
Something. We'll never run out of things to talk about. But about wine, to demystify the idea of tasting wine. My guest has been Pascaline Lapeltier. You can find her on the floor at Rouge Tomate, New York City, 60th Street. It happens to be... I'll tell you about the restaurant later. It's a great restaurant where the food's amazing. It's got a Michelin star and the... what you don't know when you're eating there is that it's really, really healthy and really good for you. That's sort of the soft sell. Yes. Amazing restaurant with an incredible wine list and Pascaline on the floor. Thanks so much for coming on Food Talk for the first time. We'll get you back. Yeah. Folks, stay where you are. We have a couple of minutes break to give a shout out to people that help support this show, friends of mine, friends of this station. And then I'm going to have, without any further ado, my next chef friend on who's been around. We'll find out if he's been in New York longer than I have. I suspect he may have been. Anyway, I'll introduce him when he's on mic. We'll be right back.
That swarms to her, paralyzed by what is.
Mike Alameco here. Any good chef will be honest with you and tell you about 80% of good results from cooking is good shopping. You have to start with great ingredients. So when I'm looking to make a canned tomato sauce at home, I use Cento San Marzano tomatoes, which I've loved, used them for years. When I had my restaurant, that's what I bought. When I was a chef at restaurants and I could supervise the purchasing, that's what I ordered. They're great. I actually had a chance a few years back to go visit the area where they're from because I'm always curious with ingredients. What is the provenance? So we flew in the middle of August to this little region just in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius where there's great volcanic soil. And what I found out was these tomatoes come from lots of small family farms, little quarter and half acre plots where that's what they do. They raise tomatoes and sell it to the Cento factory that packs this tomato in the peak of the season in the middle of the summer. Cento nourishes the San Marzano tomatoes from start to finish with a 100% certified traceability program. Cento's San Marzano certification is the only one of its kind, assuring the consumer of authentic San Marzano tomatoes. So if you're looking for great canned tomatoes for great tomato sauce, look no further than Cento brand San Marzano. Mike Alameco here. When I started my PBS show, one of the deals with producing a PBS show is you're always looking for underwriters, and I thought, let me start first by going after people whose products I actually use in my kitchen. I had a restaurant for years. I used Colavita olive oil. I did some research and found out that in the extra virgin category, it was the only Italian olive oil that was actually 100% Italian origin. There's a lot of stuff going on in that business that we don't really want to talk about, but a lot of the big brands call themselves Italian, have Italian flags on the labels, and their blends from tank farms from all over the planet. Pretty much based on price. Colavita is the exception. Really love the oil. Been using it in my house. Reused it in my restaurant. Well, Colavita is doing something neat. They're doing a contest. If you go to italycontest.com or colavita.com, where there's a link, but again, Italy Contest is the more direct way to do it. They're doing a contest on substituting butter for olive oil in baking goods. The winning recipe gets a free trip to Italy, courtesy of Colavita. So if you're thinking about cooking with olive oil and you're a baker, throw them your recipe at italycontest.com or visit colavita.com and click the link there. You may win a trip to Italy.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Hey, folks, welcome back. Food Talks, the show, Heritage Radio Network is what you're listening to. I'm your host, Mike Alameco. My guest for this particular segment is a guy that's been in New York. So, Sam Hazen, Chef Sam Hazen. I don't know when you first came on my radar. Probably when we filmed that Jean-Jacques Rachou show, because I wanted to get, I wanted to do a tribute to a chef that was so important to New York. Not just New York, but a generation of American chefs, really. That was the distinction with Jack. Mm-hmm. So Jean-Jacques Rachou, for those of you that don't know, was an orphan from the south of France, no education, formal education, illiterate when he came to the States as a young man. Was adopted, worked on a farm, was almost treated like, you know, a farm animal for years, got his first restaurant job at 13, worked his way up, never looked back, and, you know, everyone would like to think that the New York restaurant scene happened 5 minutes ago somewhere in Brooklyn. Really? 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 Shut the fuck up. No, no, no. Go back in time. It doesn't go that way. The restaurant scene in New York was dominated for a long time. Let's say the post-Pavillon era, because that's kind of when the modern thing began. Bunch of French chefs got stranded here at the World's Fair. World War II broke out. They couldn't go home. Out of that came a restaurant called Le Pavillon. From that restaurant, restaurants like La Côte Basque, Lutèce, et cetera, et cetera. All the old Les Laws sort of grew out of that same fertile soil. But here was the conundrum. You're a young American cook in the 1960s or 70s. Maybe you went to culinary school. You graduated. You come to New York and you want to work in a French kitchen. All the French chefs said, nope, we don't hire Americans full time. when my Poissonnier is on vacation in July, you can fill in for him. Or if my Saucier is on vacation, maybe you can fill. But I don't hire Americans. It was a mafia. You had to be French to work in a French kitchen. The man that changed that was Jean-Jacques Rachou, which was huge. They threw him out of the Vittel Club. No one could understand why he was hiring Americans. Charlie Palmer, you, Frankie Crispo. I mean, go on. Give us a list of names.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is what you mentioned about American chefs trying to get into French kitchens. Exactly what happened with me is you know, I did a fellowship when I was graduated the Culinary Institute of America back in 82. With the same instructor Charlie Palmer did.
Yeah, and, Roland.
It was Chef Dannens, Leon.
Chef Dannens, who was in the E-Room.
Yeah, exactly.
Belgian
right.
guy.
Yeah, exactly right.
And crazy guy.
Unbelievable.
But we could all have Dannens stories. He was out of his mind. He would not be able to teach there today because he would have gotten arrested.
Without a doubt, he would have lasted about 2 minutes. You know. Yeah. And I taught at the Culinary for 3 years, and it's a changed animal since the day.
So
I was there.
What year? What month did you graduate?
I graduated in February of 82. I did a
fellowship. Damn you, month ahead. I'm a month ahead of him. I graduated in January of 82.
And the interesting thing was I did a fellowship in the in-room for 3 months. And when we would, on Sundays, go to Chef Dannon's house to eat, we would actually, he would invite all his ex-fellows up.
Wow.
And Charlie, of course, was there. And,
right.
You know, instead of being like Mike, I wanted to be like Charlie. And so I contacted Charlie and met Rick Moonen and they introduced me to Rachou, and they took me over. At that point, Rick was working at Le Cirque, so I met Alan Sayak, and you know, I went over to go see Andre Sultner at Lutèce, and I wasn't even able to get into the door. You know, one thing about Rachou is he sat you down, he spoke to you, and mentioned to me he didn't have a job for me at that point. And I think it was for at least 6 or 7 weeks. I would call him every Monday, and he'd say, no job. And then eventually what happened was Todd English left.
That's right. Todd was in that kitchen,
and
too.
So what happened was
best thing
he,
that ever happened to him. I don't know what he's done since, but anyway.
Yeah.
Those were his good days.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Any case. So
so that's funny. So you were Todd's English's replacement. That's great.
And, you know, it was unbelievable. I mean, imagine the opportunity to work with the chefs that did work there and that, you know, and where they went and the tree that they created. I mean, you think of Charlie and with David Burke and, you know, even you probably don't even remember is Ollie Barker. And Ollie was Ollie was the first chef at Union Square Cafe.
Yep.
And Ollie, we were bookends. I was on the meat station. He was on the fish station. But it was an incredible experience. I mean, with Rachou painting plates and wandering through the kitchen with
Greg Godin. I remember Greg Godin was in that kitchen. You remember Greg?
Oh, sure.
Greg was there. And his wife at the time, because he's had several since, his wife was a hairdresser. And that's where that idea came of squeeze tubes.
Yeah,
now, squeeze tubes are so last generation. But so if you're today a fan of dots and foam and smoked, whatever they're doing out, you know, foraging pine needles in the New Nordic, back then, cutting edge was what Rachou was doing on those plates.
And he was the only one that was really doing
the
it.
The only one.
And creating beautiful plates, and he would sit up in the dining room every night at the voiture slicing the veal, the saddle of lamb, or the rack of lamb. It was an incredible experience, and you know, besides the culinary, it absolutely sprungboard me into where I am today. I mean, I wouldn't be where I would be if it wasn't for Jean-Jacques Rachou.
It was the first elite kitchen in America run by a Frenchman that had an American staff. The first one. Everyone else was all French. It was crazy. Perrier in Philly, to some extent, Blanchet in Chicago. French. Maybe you can get an American guy in. Rachou's the guy that broke the mold. We all owe him a debt.
Well, I think also the thing about Rachou that was interesting is he had a pastry chef that was French, and he had a chef. You know, his chef de cuisine or sous chef, Jacques Croustade or André Guillard. And then you had Jean-Pierre Lamaison in pastry, who I worked with again as an instructor at the Culinary Institute of America. But other than that, it was loaded with young American chefs. And, you know, we were all proud and, you know.
And you had your notebook, and every night you'd go home and you'd draw pictures of the play. I mean, we all still have those books, right?
You know, it's interesting. One of the things that, you know, there's a book coming out about, you know, chefs of the 80s, and I was interviewed for that. And one of the things I brought to the interview was a book that I had, and from day one, it's unbelievable. I even actually gave Rachou, we met him probably 15 years later. He had a reunion with all the chefs, and I gave him the book. He had tears in his eyes from the book. I mean, drawing each of the plates and what was on the plates.
The recipes, the specials. Because this is before, you know, for you young kids, before cell phones, before pictures, before cameras, before computers, basically. We had all of our, because I still have those notebooks of recipes from when I got to New York City. Mm-hmm. That I kept in ring-bound notebooks where it was every day what I did, arrows drawn how I cooked it, and that's how you remember it.
I mean, I can still, where I sit in my desk at home now, I can still reach for it, and I still look at it because I'm honored to be part of it.
Well, great, and you are. It's a great piece of New York history. I had dinner with Christian Delouvrier last week, really one of the last of the Mohicans. He's a little over 70 years old now, still working the stoves, plying his craft in kind of a a below-the-radar restaurant called Le Mangeoir on 53rd and 2nd Avenue. But Christian and Jacques were great friends, and Christian was one of those a little bit younger than them, but of that cloth. And he mentioned that Thomas Keller really does a lot of outreach to thank those older French guys.
Well, I mean,
who've kind of fallen out of fashion today, because the food press today just worships, you know, who's the hottest 25-year-old with a full sleeve of tattoos and piercings and slick back hair and the biggest Twitter fucking account or Instagram douchebag. Well, you know, back then it was what you did on the plate, and you had to work your ass off to get it done. It wasn't like where you came in on Top Chef or who retweeted you.
Well, and don't forget the sriracha. So, you
know. Yeah. So what are you up to today? You got a big thing going on.
Well, I got something that's really exciting, and I'm very excited to be part of it. I'm going to be the executive chef of the new Park Hyatt that's on 57th Street, and probably where is that? It's the building that had the incident with the crane, and it's unbelievable. If you see it, I mean, it has 210 rooms. It has a residence
between 6th and
6th and 7th. And it's right across the street from Carnegie Hall.
So the Meridian's around the corner, Bettany's around the corner, Rue 57's on the corner.
Yeah, Trump is there.
Because I work out every day at the athletic club, so that's every morning I find myself in that hood.
But it's you know, the stage that they've provided for me is just unbelievable. I mean, with no name and with really, I'm not.
So it's not named restaurant. This is really hard to do PR in front of this. So, folks, hold on. You ready for this? We're going to give you an address. We're not going to give you a phone number. This is how cool it is. This is kind of like the opening of Ye Waverly. Well, and we're not sure if you can get in.
What I was going to actually do is we were going to do this interview, and I was even going to give you my name.
That's right. Pull a Graydon Carter on.
Yeah. But it's amazing. I mean, and it's going to be incredible when we open. The attention to detail, and you know, it's just something like I've never seen before. I mean, sitting in an office and listening to two people to talk about for an hour about what kind of umbrellas we're going to have just tells you the attention to detail that we're paying attention to.
And you're, you know, this is great because you're a guy that's been around. I mean, we went to school at the same time. I'm assuming we're right around the same age. You're a chef in full, and this will be the biggest thing you've done. And we should mention, well, not biggest in terms of size, because you were the chef at Dow.
Yeah.
At one point, which is like the factory. I mean, I remember when
if you think about it, I did Tao for, you know, I created Tao in New York. I created Tao in Las Vegas.
Tao in Las Vegas was the restaurant that broke. I used to work at Tavern on the Green as a night chef for years. We were the highest grossing restaurant for the longest time at 32, 33, 34 million. Mm-hmm. Tao Vegas opens up and it's 50 and change.
Well, and it's even more than that. You know, the funny thing is everything was 50 and change. A lot of it was from the nightclub. And quite frankly, it was $65 million. And 45 was food. And 15 of the 45 was banquet. So we did $30 million in a la carte. I mean, on New Year's Eve, we'd do $2 million in business. But, you know, everybody thinks factory, shovel the food out. Wasn't that at all. I mean, you wouldn't create something like that and keep the level of business they still have today without having some stability and having some credibility.
Yeah, Ralph just emailed me. He wants me to come down to the new one down in the meatpacking.
Yeah,
good guy.
Yeah, Ralph was a sous chef when I was there. Ralph's doing a great job. He understands volume, and I left the place with great systems, which.
So opening a hotel, you're going to have a lot of balls in the air. So you're going to have room service. You're going to have 24-hour. You're going to be overseeing this beast, right?
Well, there's a lot of moving parts.
Right.
But it's moving parts in different areas. Well, I think all restaurants have a lot of moving parts, but I think what's interesting
about this is a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, but it's moving parts with I'm given the ability and the ingredients to make those moving parts work. It's well-oiled. I'm coming with a great backing of Park Hyatt, which is a pro of what they do.
You know, it's interesting to see what's going to happen here. You're going to have your hands full. What are some of the things? I know the restaurant doesn't have a name yet. It's going to be the Park Hyatt. That's the name of the hotel. Mm-hmm. Address is 153 West 57th Street. Big crosstown block uptown. You'll be between 6th and 7th. What's the direction? Do we have one yet for the main dining room? It's going to be fine dining?
They've given me, it's going to be fine dining, but it's going to be casual enough that people are going to want to eat there all the time. It's going to be my style of food. I mean, I feel very comfortable in my shoes. As you said, I've been doing this for a long time. So it's things that I've done in the past have been very, very successful. It's going to be great ingredients, proper technique, sourced well, and presented simply. I mean, so it's going to be food for everybody and, you know, with Park Hyatt running through my veins.
How many seats in the main in the fine dining room?
It's going to have 90 seats, but
that's not too bad.
Well, you're going to have you have a great bar lounge area that overlooks Carnegie Hall, which is we're going to have a great selection of champagnes and a great variety of different kinds of foods and different level of food that we're going to serve other than we serve in the restaurant.
Opening date slated for
summer, early summer. It's like the name. We're not sure yet.
That's the name. You're not sure yet. Just Google. We're not sure yet. Excuse me, I misspelled that. We're not, stick with it. It might work. Or call it kale. That might work. Somebody gave me that hint the other day. Kale's at its moment. Okay. Oh, name restaurant kale. So that'll be fine. So soft opening. New York in the summer is usually not so crazy. It's kind of a touristy time. New Yorkers tend to get out of Dodge, myself included.
I think it's pretty anticipated. So I think people are waiting for this to happen, as I am, and as the whole team is. And I think there's a lot of excitement around it. I think we say that it's going to open up slow, but I think the floodgates are going to open and everybody's going to want to be there.
Do you have a front of the house organized yet? Do we have a maitre d', a somm hired? Anybody?
As a matter of fact, we have. I brought along with me. Of course, I was at Veritas.
Which is ridiculous. So there was crew and there were Veritas. Right. And if you were going back 8 or 9 years, if you had an unlimited budget and loved great wines, those were the two restaurants you went to, because it was basically private collectors that decided to open up a restaurant and.
I think with Veritas, it was, at the point when I got there, it was a wine cellar with a restaurant attached. And
that's what it was.
I think I moved it around. It was more of a restaurant.
3-star review, great review. I was there the night that review came out.
That was very, very special.
That was huge.
Very special.
Great, great exclamation point on your career.
And I also think that what's interesting about the Park Hyatt venture is that, it's not going to be a restaurant and a hotel. It's really a restaurant that's attached to a hotel, and they want that. They don't want it to be known as a hotel restaurant. They want it to be known as a restaurant where you can stay there if you'd like.
Yeah, I was like I mentioned, 2.5 years I was the chef at the Maurice, which was a hotel in a restaurant, and I'm well aware of the bias that New Yorkers have with hotel restaurants that goes back. I don't know why. It's funny because you go back a couple of generations. Think of the great restaurants of the 50s, maybe like the Waldorf Astoria. Those were hotel restaurants. I mean, and then at some point, the idea for New Yorkers of walking through a lobby that might be full of people from somewhere else, or eating at a table where you might have people from around you that are staying upstairs, was somehow anathema. I have no idea how that happened. But if you think of the tradition of great New York hotel chefs, where John George going to start? The Drake?
Lafayette
Swiss Certainly. Hotel.
I was thinking that bubble was above my head.
Thank you.
As
so
you're mentioning that.
We think about that. We think about where was Ducasse when Ducasse was here, behind the Essex House on that 58th Street side. Mm-hmm. Delouvrier came out of L'Espinasse. I mean, there is a tradition of great hotel dining.
Oh, without a doubt.
L'Espinasse. Yeah. It was a great 10-year run in the St. Regis.
Across the street from Le Cote Basque.
Yeah.
So that was a great hotel restaurant.
You're hiring cooks?
Yeah, I'm hiring cooks and hiring, interviewing, and as a matter of fact, he's doing a pastry tasting for me on Tuesday. I have a great pastry chef that I'm sure I'm going to hire who has a pretty formative background. He's worked at Percet and has worked at Bouchon, and he's worked with Gordon Ramsay at the London Hotel. My chef de cuisine, Solange Johnson, was with me at Veritas for the whole full time. She's going to be the chef of the restaurant, knows my style.
Female.
Yeah.
Good for you.
No,
great. We're
great.
Seeing, again, we're seeing this. Just a couple of weeks ago, I had the chef from, the new chef de cuisine from Marea coming on this program, as well as Saul Bolton's chef at Red Gravy, mm-hmm. who came up through Avoce, through Missy's Kitchen. There was lots of women. So we're seeing this again. What was her name?
Solange Johnson.
So at some point, UPR guys that are listening, when the restaurants open, and maybe after the opening, maybe next September, we should get her on the show, assuming everything goes well.
No,
I'd love to have her, because we're trying to get women in the industry on the show.
It's funny, you go back to my days when I was at Le Cote Basque, if you thought about a woman in the kitchen today, I mean...
No, it was impossible. We came up at the same time. Wife now was my girlfriend then. We met at the CIA, and the reason I got a job at the Maurice is she did her internship. She did one in Texas, and hated it. She came back to New York City, and she got a job at the Maurice, and it was pastry. You had two choices. Back then, if you walked into, I think it was just the old French guys. It was just this mentality that women would like explode on the line or melt or something. But you really saw no women on the hotline. Your only chance was pastry or garmanger. That was it. That was the beginning and the end.
Yeah. I mean, but Solange, she's me. I mean, she cooks like me.
She's a beast. She's great.
She's got incredible taste buds. She knows style. She knows simplicity. She doesn't cut corners. She doesn't play around with the food. She doesn't have a pair of tweezers. I mean, she's good.
Easy with the tweezers, man.
Tweezer cuisine.
I'm telling you, it's the truth, and I'm not going to name names or mention restaurants, but I film in kitchens, so I witness tweezer cuisine. Those
that's what
3-minute, 4-minute pickups from get the food out of the kitchen.
Where's my tweezers?
Right, quit flipping over the microgreens. Dude, let it go. It's fine.
Oh, right.
So that's great. So I asked you about hiring, because it's a real challenge these days. I mean, you're...
Well, I mean, I, you know...
Find many good cooks. I mean, every chef, because you and I have been around, so many chefs I talk to, and I don't mean just old guys. I mean, Marco Canora, chefs I have in here, guys that I know, that we're filming shows pretty much every other week in New York City, so I'm in kitchens all the time, and I'm getting asked all the time, do you know any good cooks? Do you know any good cooks? Well, I can't find anybody. It's gotten really thin.
It's gotten really thin. You know, and the interesting thing is it's gotten thin, and also I think, you know, cooks today, have they skip. Well, we didn't skip, or we couldn't skip, because if we skipped, we wouldn't be where we are today. And what's great about the time that we were cooking, and I'm still cooking, and you're still talking about cooking, is the fact that, you know, we went through every layer, and we touched everything. And today, it doesn't seem like, I mean, they'd be more interested in doing what I'm doing today than being in the kitchen. And for me, this is great, but I like to be in the kitchen as well still.
Yeah, you're chef. I mean, it's great. Okay. It's funny because Dan Silverman just moved uptown
right to
the Regency. I had Dan on this show maybe a month or two ago, and you know, there was a downtown guy that had worked at the Standard, and you know, you think might have opened up his own place somewhere in the East Village, and so there's this sort of percolation now of hotel dining in New York City where they're getting really good chefs to come in and say, let's do destination food here. Why did you know? Doesn't this is what it's about?
Park High. It's a great setup. I mean, for me, it's the best setup I've ever had.
How did you hear about him? I'm curious. How'd the job come to you, or you come to the job?
It kind of came to me, and what happened was our peer company, Bullfrog and Baum, Jennifer.
I've heard of them. Heard of them.
You know them.
Small to middling firm in Midtown, Jennifer Baum, whose husband's rather inconsequential in his own right. Yeah, I've heard of them. I know who they are.
So Jennifer was a fan of Veritas, and when they were in search of a chef for the hotel and for the restaurant, Jennifer contacted me. And
that's interesting.
And so you know, they interviewed a lot of people, and really what they wanted, and I think I'm the perfect fit for it, is they wanted a New York chef with a New York DNA. I mean, who's better? And
that's all. Well, that would be the trouble. You bring some. I'm not saying that it's impossible to pick somebody up that doesn't know this town and drop them in, but to have someone here that knows the vendors, that knows the customers, that knows the critics, that knows the audience, that knows who you're cooking for, and has a network with other chefs is just fucking
it's
huge.
It's priceless.
It's huge.
It's absolutely priceless. And, you know, I've always said this, and I'm, you know, maybe I'm putting myself out by saying this. It's very difficult for chefs to come out of New York City, to come to New York City and be successful. It's a tough city. Yeah. You know, when you leave work, it's tough. You know, going to work is tough. And then at work, it's tough as well. So it's a challenge from beginning to end, and you got to be callous to it, and you got to understand it. And besides, I love New York City. I appreciate, you know, what it's done for me and what I could do for them.
Where were you from originally?
Originally, I was born in Brooklyn.
You're a Brooklyn kid. Okay. You know, I'm having dinner tonight. It's funny. You come in, I never dress like this. But I'm having dinner tonight with friends who are coming in from out of town with Michael LaMonaco's Porterhouse, another Brooklyn guy who's done great. Pure New York DNA.
Exactly.
A guy like
Mike's
you.
A great guy.
Great guy. Spent his career in the kitchens. Really not a misstep in there. Is lucky to be alive. He was downstairs getting his eyes
checked at
an ophthalmologist. The day he was the chef at Windows, day the planes hit, and should have been upstairs in his office at that time of day. Lucky to have him around. RIP. I worked at Windows for a year at Cellar in the Sky, so we all had friends that anyway, that was a tough day. But
for all of us.
But I'm going to a boxing match at New York Athletic Club. The Golden Gloves semifinals are tonight, and my stupid club has a dress code. Fucking Christ. Guys, it's 2013-14. And no jeans. I got to wear a jacket, so sorry for the outfit. But anyway, you look good.
I mean, with the way I'm dressed.
Yeah, you're all dressed up, man.
It's you know, this is my dress code. New Park Hyatt dress code.
Where was the last gig?
Veritas.
Veritas was. And when did you leave? When it closed? Did it close? No.
Yeah, we did. You know what happened was, believe it or not, just like anything in New York City, restaurant was only 46 seats. Very, very difficult. I mean, it was, you know, when we were first approached to take over Veritas, and it was a group of us, and keeping Park Smith involved with it. He was the main person involved with the wine. You know, I said from day one, there's no way a restaurant of 46 seats is going to make any money, especially with the food that they wanted me to serve. It was very, 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 very difficult.
Right.
You know, our lease was up, and the rent went up by $10,000.
Yeah,
it was just unaffordable.
That's the New York story.
Right, it's unaffordable.
That's
so, you know, I pulled the plug. I was just, you know, I'm not going to go to work 12 hours, 6 days a week, and fight to do payroll, fight to pay purveyors.
Right.
You know, so it was
well, great. You're a New York vet. Look, you're like a cat that drops 20 stories and lands on its feet and gets up and dusts itself off. Bang, you're back on the top again.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was joking, by the way, for the record, Bullfrog and Baum is, of course, a major player.
No, Jennifer's great.
In the industry, Jennifer Baum, I have great respect for, and her husband, Mike Whiteman's a cool guy who's got deep New York DNA as well. Anyway, got to wrap it up. It's been an hour. My guest has been Sam Hazen. We will wait for the restaurant to be named. We'll wait for an opening date. We'll make those announcements on this show when they come out. And then we can talk more specifically about the food. And I'm going to give you the summer to get through your gestation period of opening. I will come in next September and try the food, brother.
I'll be thrilled to
give you the summer. By then, I'll be in Cape May for a couple of months, coming back to New York, chomping at the bit to be fed. Yeah, go to the athletic club, swim my ass off, and then come to you, and you'll feed me.
Oh, whatever. Definitely.
Thanks so much. Look forward to that restaurant. Again, we don't have the name of the restaurant because it isn't named yet. It's called something or other. The Park Hyatt is the hotel, 153 West 57th Street. Sam Hazen will be the chef. I'm sure it's going to be interesting. And on that note, we'll see you next week for – who are my guests next week? Hold on for 1 second. Stay where we are. I got a bunch of guests. Oh, yeah. We're going to hear a lot about vegetarian cuisine next week. Deborah Madison, who just had a book coming out. Emily Abrams, who's like 19 years old and wrote a book called Save the Planet. I don't know about this, but it's going to be interesting. And Laura Russell, who wrote another great cook about cooking vegetables. So get ready for that next week. From wine to Sam to vegetables next week. That's what's on the menu. See you then, folks. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.